It's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, are we being played? A look at the war in Iraq. Plus, we've got the global warming update, the president's horoscope, a new sponsor, and the Water Weenie Award. And welcome! Welcome to podcast number 21 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David. And welcome. I'm glad to be back. Sorry about the delay in getting the newest podcast up. Was going to try to do everything on the weekend, try to get as much as I could get done. And unfortunately, I left. You have to forgive me. A lot of things going on lately. I left a lot of my stuff at work, so I feel a little silly about that, but it's unfortunately what happened, and with the weekend passing by, I didn't get to get my podcast up, because all your good stuff, all your notes, they're at work, and I wasn't about to go back to work, since I live in Santa Ana, works in L.A., and there is no way I'm going all the way back to L.A. to get those types of notes, so I apologize about the delay. I also want to apologize about not getting the research links up for podcast number 20. I usually have most of that stuff up within a couple of days, as I've said, and I do apologize. A lot of things going on. It's just been a very hectic time, and I will work on getting as much of the newest stuff up as possible. It's going to be a very busy time in getting a lot of podcasts out. If it's overwhelming to you, I apologize. Just have a lot of stuff that has to be covered. I am going to try to make this one short, the next one short, and then try to get back onto a regular schedule, as one of my listeners asked me to do. So I appreciate that, and I am going to work hard to try to get back onto a regular schedule with the show. So I do apologize, and thank you for still listening and being there. I really appreciate everybody being there, and I especially appreciate it if you found this podcast via the Progressive Podcast Network, of which I am a very proud member. And you can find that website at progressivepodcastnetwork.org. And I also encourage you to visit their blog and forum sites found at newmediarevolutionaries.com. Quite recently, the website for the Progressive Podcast Network went through some updates, and want to thank everybody that worked on that. I wish I had those types of computer skills, but thankfully they did a great job in getting the new server system up and getting everything redone and reset. And want to thank everybody that worked on that. You guys do great work, and to everybody that's associated with the Progressive Podcast Network, just very proud to be associated with you. And unfortunately, another member of the PPN, or the Progressive Podcast Network, has said that he's going to be calling it quits for a little while. Dan, who does the Rampage podcast, which is a great podcast, has decided that he's going to take a little bit of time off from doing podcasting. And for 3 years, that guy has just been doing incredible work. So to the Rampage podcast, thank you for spreading the word and getting as much of the message out as possible. I can't even begin to express the type of awe that I have for the work that you've done. So enjoy your time. I hope you come back soon, because there's still a lot of work to do, a lot of messages to get out. But where would I be if I did not work on getting that messages out, if I did not give you the global warming update? And this one's an interesting one. This one I heard about, actually, when I heard about it, I said to myself, that's too much. But it gets into the celebrity stuff, and I know how some people feel about that. They want to hear the real news. Well, I just feel this is something we should talk about. And the story I'm going to read to you is called Flying with the Filthy Rich, the World's Top 10 Eco-Sinners. Sinners. Okay. Here they are. The story goes as such. When Tony Blair announced he had no intention of giving up long-haul flights, environmental groups were enraged. Although emissions from aviation account for a small percentage of the greenhouse gases produced by the UK, most campaigners say restricting flights will be an important part of cutting our carbon footprints. So, when it comes to flying, these are the top 10 eco-sinners as listed by this article. And this comes in no order, but here are some names. Donatella Versace. Vulgar wealth and Versace have always gone hand in hand, and the latest accessory is the private jet. Tom Cruise. The Top Gun star is so disliked by the eco lobby, he has been dubbed Emissions Impossible. John Travolta. Travolta once starred in a movie about bringing industrial polluters to justice, but in real life, he probably has the biggest carbon footprint of any Hollywood star. David Beckham. His footwork may be fancy, but he gets the red card for his carbon footprint. Just one flight from London to Madrid releases 450 kilograms of carbon into the atmosphere. Add together his international trips last year, and his emissions clock up to an estimated 15,000 kilograms of carbon dioxide. God, I hope I'm saying that right. This is all in metrics. We're American. What do we know from metrics? Let's see. Victoria Beckham. Ah, Posh Spice. Her 2002 autobiography was called Learning to Fly, and she's never really stopped since. During the World Cup, her plane from Madrid was grounded due to engine failure, so she simply chartered a private jet at a cost of £21,000 to get her to Germany on time. Michael O'Leary, he's the environmentalist public enemy number one. He's the boss of Ryanair and proudly declares his intention to increase its airline carbon emissions. Sharon Osbourne, another TV star who just can't resist the lure of the Learjet. Philip Green, a billionaire who owns 2,500 stores, including Topshop, Miss Selfridge, and BHS. He avoids paying millions of pounds in taxes by living in Monaco, but dumps thousands of kilos of carbon on the rest of us from his cherished Gulfstream jet as he commutes back and forth from London. Roman Abramovich is a governor of a far eastern province of Russia, but there's not much chance you'll spot him heading there on Aeroflot. Instead, he owns the big daddy of private jets, a Boeing 767 that would normally seat 180 people. And lastly, Simon Cowell. The X Factor judge is not the type to make excuses for his lifestyle. For the X Factor auditions in Dublin, he flew in and out on the same day in a private jet. He says he likes his private jets because the champagne's better and you can smoke, which is a rare pleasure these days at 36,000 feet. You gotta admit, I gotta do it. You gotta have a little fun with that. That was the worst impression of an environmentalist I have ever seen. It was terrible. I don't mean to be rude, but that was awful. And that was my really awful British accent. You'd think I'd have a good one after, you know, living there for a little while, but that was 15 years ago, so what can I do? But those are the top 10 eco-sinners. Okay, now that I've given you the global warming updates, of course, where would I be if I did not tell you the president's horoscope? So, didn't do it last time in the podcast, but here it is. From the pages of Elle magazine, and as we know, our president is a Cancer. Here is his presidential horoscope for the week of February 5th through the 11th. Big opportunities may be presented midweek, but it is crucial that you leave meetings with a signed term sheet or a deal memo, not just a lot of big promises. Instead of making decisions on the fly, run everything by a hard-nosed attorney. You know, he's got that with Alberto. Not only is he hard-nosed, but he's kind of creepy. Yeah, mm-hmm. Unless things are done right, misunderstandings could develop. Oh, that makes so much sense when you think about the lack of bipartisanship that's about to occur. But here's the rest. So, don't rush through this. Make sure you and your team have covered every possible detail. Chances are you won't be able to complete this process until next week or later. Or until the next president comes into office and then he'll just dump everything on them. Let's face it, this horoscope's probably messed up. This week's touchstones are Hiddenite and Rhyolite. And I am going to have to look those up later on after I finish recording. Don't know what those are. I hope you do.
Tired of falling asleep during NPR? Bored of uptight news anchors? The Unimpressed Corps might be just for you. From politics to pop culture, this weekly podcast is sure to please even the crankiest liberal. Go to www.unimpressedcore.com or the iTunes Music Store and subscribe now. The Unimpressed Corps may contain language not suitable for children.
Last week, columnist Molly Ivins passed away. She died at the age of 62 from cancer. She was a critic of the president before it was fashionable. She held a wit that most people only dream about. She was an accomplished journalist and author. She was a liberal. But mostly, she was a writer. And as a writer, she did more than relay facts. She told us the story she felt must be told with passion, strength, humor, and deep hope and conviction that it could inspire. Inspire people to, at the very least, think a second time and at its best make us act. In that act, or in her art, lies a beauty that takes us beyond the superficiality of looks and offers a glimpse into her heart, mind, and soul to listen or understand that beyond her gender, beyond her ethnicity, and beyond the disease that robbed us of her life are words and feelings that are immortal. Molly Ivins offered herself as a voice beyond any labels. She offered it to fuel people's minds. Agree or disagree, if you could not respect her wit, you missed out on what makes the written word so special. To give you an idea of the writer she was and the insight she had, here are some of her best quotes as collected by Paul Krugman regarding the war in Iraq back in 2002 through 2003. From November 19, 2002, "The greatest risk for us in invading Iraq is probably not war itself, so much as what happens after we win. There is a batty degree of triumphalism loose in this country right now." From January 16, 2003, "I assume we can defeat Hussein without great cost to our side. God forgive me if that is hubris. The problem is what happens after we win. The country is 20% Kurd, 20% Sunni, and 60% Shiite. Can you say horrible three-way civil war?" From July 14, 2003, "I opposed the war because I thought it would lead to the peace from hell, but I'd rather not see my prediction come true." From October 7, 2003, "Good thing we won the war, because the peace sure looks like a quagmire. I've got an even money bet out that says more Americans will be killed in the peace than in the war, and more Iraqis will be killed by Americans in peace than in war. Not the first time I've had a bet out that I'd hoped I'd lose." Molly Ivins wrote, with her characteristic strength, to say that even after her life, there is a battle we all must fight. I quote from her final column, "We are the people who run this country. We are the deciders. And every single day, every one of us needs to step outside and take some action to help stop this war. Raise hell. Think of something to make the ridiculous look ridiculous. Make our troops know we're for them and trying to get them out of there. Hit the streets to protest Bush's proposed surge. If you can, go to the peace march in Washington on January 27th. We need people in the streets banging pots and pans and demanding, stop it now." It makes you think long and hard when you hear the words of somebody whose conviction and beliefs stretches beyond their disease, and the fight in them doesn't end even when they know the turn of events that their life is headed for. There's great courage that goes beyond having to face a disease that would define most people. But that was not the type of person that Molly Ivins was, and it's a testament to many people like her who believe that you have to fight beyond just what is happening in your life, that there are things bigger and greater than us that we have to fight for and believe in. Before I end this segment, if you would like to hear some great interviews with Molly, please go to democracynow.org and download the episode for February 1st, 2007. They'd have some wonderful interviews and some great background on Molly Ivins, the person and the writer. Suffice it to say, our world loses something special with the passing of those who make us think, act, and inspire our souls. Those people who challenge us live in our hearts and minds always. Molly Ivins' ability to fight in the face of the disease that ravaged her body is a testament to the striving of our humanity to be a better and stronger people. For that, she will live forever. May she rest in peace. On a slight personal note, losing someone whose will and spirit and wit are strong, especially to cancer, is no small thing. But watching the fight and them continue on to inspire you to go on and keep on fighting for the things that you believe in is the greatest gift that that person will continue to give you. To that I speak of my grandmother who passed away from cancer nearly 3 years ago. She was the strong light in my life, and she was the fighter who was not ready to go when cancer took her life. She was the person I talked with most about politics growing up, and she was the person who always encouraged me and told me to fight for the things that I believed in. So maybe this takes a different note for me beyond the writer that is Molly Ivins. I do read her columns. I do own one of her books. But I'm reminded on a day like today, and with the passing of a person like her, what is most important to fight in, even in the face of the things that we cannot overcome. In all things like that, it's important to remember to continue on in their name and in their spirit. And now, here's a message from the Progressive Podcast Network.
Having their jobs sent overseas is only the beginning of the pain for some American workers. Many are also having to train their replacement.
There is now a growing multi-billion dollar industry that's helping these companies send American work overseas.
Our president, George Bush, says that it's really best for our, well, for America's economy.
Outsourcing!
If our jobs go overseas.
Outsourcing is the answer to everything.
I'm very glad to see you favor outsourcing.
And the type of work being offshored has gone way beyond call center.
We were told that we had to train them in order to be eligible for severance and unemployment benefits.
All made possible by the internet. Developed by Americans.
It was terrible. I felt absolutely thrown away.
The jobs that are being lost to offshore are not cyclical. They are not likely to ever be coming back.
U.S. companies that hire cheap foreign workers instead of American citizens.
Latin American guest workers are routinely abused and underpaid under the H-2A and H-2B visa programs.
The system lends itself to abuse and exploitation.
When I was first starting my career, company loyalty was important, and that just doesn't seem to matter anymore.
We already have guest worker programs in the United States, and we should look at what they are in practice. And what they are in practice is basically indentured servitude.
Maybe the president's job should go overseas.
Listen to the Progressive Geek Podcast, a proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. Visit progressivegeek.com.
In thinking about the last podcast talking about Iran and the British claims of no evidence of such weapons coming into Iraq, I found myself sort of focused on finding more stories regarding the role of Iran in Iraq and the escalation of troops that is being planned into places such as Al-Anbar. With Iranians now being arrested, including a recent Iranian envoy to Iraq, the obvious question to ask, and this is just for fairness sake, is to wonder if there are any validities to these arrests. On a fair basis, and in conjunction with the past podcast I did where I said and still believe we have created an Iraqi government that would naturally align itself with Iran, I have to admit the natural possibility that, yes, funds and resources of all types could make their way to Shia extremists and to Shias just trying to survive in this civil war against the Sunnis. It's not only unreasonable, but naive to believe that not one weapon has ever come from Iran to Iraqis. That's an argument that just from logic's natural conclusion lacks any basis. But I found an article regarding Iranian involvement into Iraq that made me think about what their involvement is. Now, the article that I found recently that really got me thinking about this was from the New York Times, Iranian Reveals Plan to Expand Role in Iraq. Iran's plan, as outlined by an ambassador, carries the potential to bring Iran into further conflict here with the United States, which has detained a number of Iranian operatives. The ambassador, Hassan Kazami Kumi, said Iran was prepared to offer Iraq government forces training, equipment, and advisors for what he called the security fight. In the economic area, Mr. Kumi said Iran was ready to assume major responsibility for Iraq's reconstruction, an area of failure on the part of the United States since American-led forces overthrew Saddam Hussein. Mr. Kumi also acknowledged for the first time that two Iranians seized and later released by American forces last month were security officials, as the U.S. had claimed. While providing few details, the U.S. has said that evidence gleaned in the Baghdad raid made on an Iraqi Shiite leader's residential compound proves that the Iranians were involved in planning attacks. How much direction, if any, Mr. Kumi was taken from his government was unclear in the interview, in which he showed disdain for the American accusations, as well as a few flashes of restrained sarcasm. He ridiculed the evidence that the American military had said it collected, including maps of Baghdad delineating Sunni, Shiite, and mixed neighborhoods, the kind of maps American officials have said that would be used for militias engaged in ethnic slaughter. Mr. Kumi said the maps were so common and easily obtainable they proved nothing. He declined to say whether he believed the maps bore sectarian markings or addressed other pieces of evidence the Americans said they found, like manifests of weapons and material relating to technology of sophisticated roadside bombs. But that is not why the Iranians were in the compound. According to Mr. Kumi, and this is a quote, they worked in the security sector in the Islamic Republic, that's clear. But he said that the Iranians were in Iraq because the two countries agreed to solve security problems. The Iranians went to meet with the Iraqi side. In a surprise announcement, Mr. Kumi said Iran would soon open a national bank in Iraq, in effect creating a new Iranian financial institution right under the American noses. A senior Iraqi banking official, Hussein al-Urzi, confirmed that Iran had received a license to open the bank, which he said apparently would be the first wholly owned subsidiary bank of a foreign country in Iraq. A number of American and Iraqi officials said Sunday that it was difficult to respond to Mr. Kumi's statements until they had been communicated through official results. Sean McCormick, a State Department spokesman, said Sunday that the U.S. had a significant body of evidence tying Iran to sectarian attacks, but he did not address any of the specifics of Mr. Kumi's comments about plans for stronger economic and security ties. So it got me thinking about the hand that we're being played and the way that we're being played. Because imagine, and this is just part of it, imagine what is lost by having Iran invest in Iraq. To companies like Halliburton, Bechtel, Khaki, Blackstar, the loss in monies would be huge. Big money is at stake, and to believe that those corporations cannot or would not lobby for the removal of such economic threats is as unreasonable as what I discussed earlier. However, in thinking of the spike in violence, including the loss of four American helicopters and a videotape of that having been released, you begin to realize how sophisticated and well-funded this all is. Recently, a national intelligence estimate was released stating how complex the war in Iraq is, that this civil war is essentially four types of wars.
This is Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
The word civil war oversimplify a very complex situation in Iraq. I believe that there are essentially four wars going on in Iraq. One is Shia on Shia, principally in the south. The second is sectarian conflict, principally in Baghdad, but not solely. Third is the insurgency. And fourth is Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is attacking, at times, all of those targets.
According to most reports, Al-Qaeda is apparently 3-7% of the fighting forces in Iraq, and according to the president in his State of the Union address, has aligned itself with Sunni extremists. Now, let's go back to the president's speech regarding the escalation to quell the violence in Al-Anbar and in Baghdad. The president in that speech blamed most of the violence on Sunni extremists. Now ask yourself this. If the amount of violence apparently is coming from Sunni extremists and from violence in the Al-Anbar and Baghdad region, why is this administration working so hard to infer that it is the Iranians that are responsible for the increase in violence? Why would a Shia-led government help the Sunnis? Makes no sense, huh? But didn't to me either. Then you have to ask yourself, who would fund the Sunnis? Well, let's listen to this clip from Democracy Now!
The Associated Press recently reported private Saudi citizens are giving tens of millions of dollars to Sunni fighters in Iraq to buy weapons, including shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles.
Not convinced of the answer yet? Not sure of what's happening? How about this?
Is that the real attacks against the United States, the place where Americans are dying most frequently, is not in the Shia territories that were mentioned before, and they're not by Shia weapons. They are by Sunni insurgents in Al-Anbar province. They are, in many cases, supported militarily, financially, by people, individuals at least, in the countries that are our new allies, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and others. Those are the people who blow themselves up in marketplaces and so forth. By focusing our attention on Iran, we're correct, I'm sure, that Iran is doing some nefarious things in the country. But our real problem lies elsewhere, and I see it as I say, an effort to change the subject.
Now, I want to be clear about this. I don't want to infer that the Iranians are completely innocent in any of the actions that are occurring in Iraq, but we also have to look at what is causing the larger instability and what we are being told in one aspect and then being told in another way. The greatest amount of violence is coming from Sunni extremists and from the Al-Anbar region, which is Sunni-dominated. Yet, we are being told that the greatest danger that we have is from the Iranians and not from the people that are funding these Sunni extremists, namely Saudi Arabia. And as we've discussed about this, and this goes into again into how we are being played, the question always comes back to, are the Saudis really our allies? From one point of view, we always have to remember that 17 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. But, as I said, that got me thinking about our allies and the House of Saud, which in Arabic is referred to as al-Fasad, or the mother of all corruption. Now, what I'm going to do is give you a brief history and read to you portions from an article called Iran versus Saudi Arabia versus the United States. When the Saudi government took its power, it established its legitimacy via a Wahhabist ideology. The masterminds, and this is a quote from this article, the masterminds of 9/11, the suicide bombers in Spain, England, Indonesia, are all Wahhabis. The gruesome beheading of hostage, mass killings of civilians by bombs, and spreading of terror is nothing new. What is new is the financial and material support that they are receiving. And I quote from this article, "For over a quarter of a century, the Wahhabi establishment in Saudi Arabia has been trying to spread its brand of Islam across the Muslim world. The funding and logistical supports have been provided by the ruling princes and their associates either directly through the state or through religious charity foundations. They have built religious schools, madrasas, and in many usually poor Muslim countries. They distribute millions of Wahhabi books around the world. They build mosques and finance the education of foreign clergies in Saudi universities. The Wahhabi ideology is being spread as never before, and it is finding converts across the globe. From all available evidence," and this is still quoting from the story, "it is clear that Saudi Arabia is actively propagating the Wahhabi ideology throughout the Muslim world. In a recent documentary entitled Dispatch, Uncover Mosque, shown on the English Channel 4, an investigative journalist with a hidden camera visited many Saudi-supported mosques to find out what was really being preached. To quote the article, it was a scary document. The preachers, most of whom were trained in Saudi Arabia, preached a violent and xenophobic version of Islam. They preached hatred of non-Muslims with a very strong anti-Western tone. In a continuation of the article, at best, these preachers encourage fighting Christians, and in a worst case, they actually recruit or participate in terror acts. Those who received training in Afghanistan and later moved to Algeria are now spreading throughout Northern Africa. The group that has brought Al-Qaeda to pro-U.S. allies in North Africa is the Salafist Brigade for Combat and Call, the last active Islamic insurgency in Algeria. The Salafist Brigade announced a merger with Al-Qaeda, which means little except that the brigade has a mandate to expand outside of Algeria in cooperation with foreign Islamic cells. Suddenly, Salafist cells, now named Al-Qaeda Organization for the Countries of the Arab Maghreb, have been growing like wildflowers in Mali, Mauritania, Morocco, and Tunisia. All of these groups adhere to the Salafi Wahhabi sect of Islam. Saudi Arabia, by financing the spread of this form of fanaticism, is indirectly or even directly aiding the very terrorist organizations she is proclaiming to fight. The House of Saud has created a monster that is threatening to devour the kingdom. To defeat it, the House of Saud has to either accommodate it by showing that they are as puritanical and fanatical as the terrorists, or fight them head-on and try to destroy them totally. And here lies the dilemma. The House of Saud relies on this religious sect for its legitimacy and survival. It cannot seriously weaken the Wahhabi establishment within the kingdom without weakening its own position. And the article continues, "Another problem facing the House of Saud is the rise of the Shiite Iran. Wahhabis consider Shiites to be heretics and Saudi Wahhabi scholars have repeatedly issued religious decrees, or fatwas, calling for the murdering of Shiites everywhere. For example, recently an influential Saudi cleric, Sheikh Abdel Rahman al-Barak, issued a fatwa calling the Shiites infidels. He argued that the rejectionists or the Shiites in their entirety are the worst of the Islamic nation's sects. They bear all of the characteristics of infidels. They are in truth polytheist infidels, though they hide this. The Sunni and Shia schools of Islam are opposites that can never agree. There can be no coming together. This decree coming out of Saudi Arabia is very similar to the statements from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In a four-hour anti-Shia sermon released on the internet a week before his death in a U.S. bombing raid in June, but apparently recorded 2 months earlier, Zarqawi ran through a list of Shia betrayals and cited a number of venomously anti-Shia tracts written by scholars in the fundamentalist Wahhabi branch of Sunni Islam. He declared that there would be no total victory over the Jews and Christians without a total annihilation of the Shia, whom he called the secret agents of Islam's enemies. If you can't find any Christians or Jews to kill, vent your wrath against the next available Shia, Zarqawi said. He claimed that his fellow terrorists, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, were only pretending to oppose Israel, while in reality, their mission was to protect Israel's northern border. Zarqawi concluded with a formal declaration of war on the Iraqi Shia leader Muqtada al-Sadr and his bastards. The article continues, Sunnis are very moderate, non-violent, and very tolerant of others. However, as mentioned before, the Wahhabis are extremists, and as such, are diametrically opposed to the Shiites. To cap it all, the Islamic Republic of Iran, a Shia government, allows gender change. Compare this to Saudi Arabia, it is no wonder that they consider Shiites to be heretics. The core of the problem is that the Shiites allow for interpretations of the law. Wahhabists are stuck in the past and abhor change. They are rigid. That is why wherever they are, be it Afghanistan, Somalia, or Algeria, they try to turn the clock back. This is what is being funded by Saudi Arabia, the very type of governments that are being set up and that we fought to overthrow in the Battle of Afghanistan. Remember this, because this is important, because think of how we are being played. The article continues, Saudi Arabia is afraid that if Iran is successful in its rise, it may become a model for Muslims in the Middle East. It may weaken and ultimately destroy the Wahhabi version. The Wahhabi clerics know that in an ideological fight, their version of Islam is going to lose. They are now looking at the United States to protect them by weakening Iran, and by all indications, the United States is obliging. Saudi Arabia is now pushing hard to contain Iran through the United States and the United Kingdom. The Associated Press reports that key Iraqi officials say private Saudi citizens are providing millions of dollars in funding to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. Much of the money is used to buy weapons. The Iraqi officials interviewed for the article say most of the money comes from private Islamic donations inside Saudi Arabia, known as zakat. The zakat is one of the five pillars of Islam, and all Muslims are obliged to give to it, primarily for the poor and needy. Two Iraqi officials said that while some of the funding goes to Iraqi Sunni leaders, who then disperse it, other channels are being used to send money directly to insurgents. The Bush administration has acknowledged that Saudi Arabia was financing the Al-Qaeda-aligned regime in Somalia. Officials said Saudi Arabia has become a leading financier of Islamic takeover of Somalia. The so-called Islamic Courts Union, headed by an Al-Qaeda commander, wanted by the United States, has garnered most of its foreign support from Saudi Arabia and Yemen. I don't want to say the Saudi government is supporting any particular Islamic court, Assistant Secretary of State Jendel Fraser said, but I do know that the money is coming in from Saudi Arabia. A new U.S. intelligence estimate concluded that Iranian and other outside meddling is not likely a major cause of the bloodshed in Iraq, and a new McClatchy analysis of U.S. casualties in Iraq found that Sunni Muslim insurgents, not Iranian-backed Shiites, have mounted most, but not all, attacks on American forces. The author in his conclusion asks, am I the only one that thinks the U.S. is looking for terrorists in all the wrong places? Am I the only one that thinks it's about time we force the House of Saud to change its policies? Am I the only one that thinks the mainstream media should begin to discuss the role of Saudi Arabia in all these problems? Am I the only one that thinks it's about time to look at Iran as a possible ally in the fight against terror rather than as an enemy? I actually added the word possible because we don't know exactly every aspect of what's going on, and it's almost an impossibility to have any type of ally when you're arresting them, killing them, and declaring an undeclared war against Iran. But he is not the only person asking this question. It is the question that we should be asking each other. How are we being played in this situation? Told that one group is causing the most violence against us. We know where the money's coming from, but we're being told to pay attention to the other side. It did not take much to realize what was going to happen. Molly Ivins and many other smart progressives knew where this was going to lead, and it was going to lead to a Shia-led government that would naturally align itself with the government of Iran. But the big question is, how are we being played? The United States is going to sit back and not allow anything to interfere with oil production coming out of Saudi Arabia. It is not in their financial interests. But how can we say that we are truly interested in our own security when we are allowing ourselves to be killed by the very people that claim to be our allies? It is time to realize that we have been played, that we are continually being played, and that when we went into this war, we chose to dance with the devil. Okay, to lighten things up a bit, I'm going to share a piece of music for you by an independent band called The Arm. The Arm, unfortunately, has broken up, but in one of their most recent MySpace bulletins, The Arm actually put up on their website, or their MySpace site, to go ahead and steal their music. Well, this is not an attempt to steal their music, but an attempt to introduce it to a band that put out one of my favorite songs of last year. I just got a kick out of it the first time I heard it. So to lighten things up a bit and to share some independent music with you, here is The Armed and a song called The Privileged Few.
I'm in.
And an interesting little side note, I was going to try to make that music, the beginning of that music, the theme music for Indirect Democracy, but fortunately, and I still love this song that was played, but fortunately, I was introduced to Megaphone and their song Not Your Enemy. And for this podcast, I think it just fits perfectly. Okay, it's time to pay the bills around here, and this is an ad from our newest sponsor.
Hi, do you suffer from foot into mouth disease?
Sorry. I mean, you got the first sort of mainstream African American,
yeah,
who is articulate and bright and clean and nice looking guy. I mean, that's a storybook, man.
Yeah. Oof, that's gotta smart. And taste awful, too. But now there's Dr. Scholl's new foot and mouth powder. It's made to handle life's little foibles.
Hey, how many months are you?
I'm not pregnant.
Size doesn't matter. Size doesn't matter. Why can't I tell him that with a straight face?
My wife asked me if she looked fat in her jeans.
Now, hear these people after Dr. Scholl's.
Hey, that does make it taste better.
Is this supposed to be peppermint?
It still tastes like foot.
Dr. Scholl's Foot and Mouth Powder. Available at all major grocery stores and pharmacies.
In Delaware, the largest growth in population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. So, boy, I'm not joking.
It even comes in extra strength. Dr. Scholl's, making your stupidity seem easier to swallow.
Okay, this week's What a Weenie Award is awarded to another in the long line of journalists whose contributions to American literature includes a book of who they consider to be the worst liberals. If you're not familiar with the name of Dinesh D'Souza, then get ready to know it. Mr. D'Souza is a journalist and contributor to the Fox News Channel and a right-wing author and critic. Mr. D'Souza recently published the following book, The Enemy at Home, where he listed the names of politicians, celebrities, and groups that he considers domestic insurgents that, and I quote, is working in tandem with Osama bin Laden to defeat President Bush. And you will not believe the names that are on this list. Shockingly, it includes the likes of Senator Ted Kennedy, the ACLU, Senator Hillary Clinton, Noam Chomsky, Martin Sheen, Susan Sarandon, Sean Penn, Rosie O'Donnell, George Soros, Cindy Sheehan, Paul Begala, Seymour Hersh, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, Charlie Rangel, and many more. How amazing! How insightful! How original! A list of bad liberals. Who would ever think of doing something like that? How about countless authors and bloggers who have written up similar lists? Come on, Mr. D'Souza. Is this the best you could do? Think of a list of bad liberals? Well, first, how dare you insinuate that because these persons disagree with you, that they would put themselves in league with a murderer? But obviously, that's all you really have to offer in a way of an argument. Debate and dissent is not un-American. Failing to question your leadership is. It's where the roots of patriotism take their form. But second, out of curiosity, I decided to look to see if there was a list of all-time worst conservatives. I did a quick Google search and found that most lists focus around liberals and progressives. So, owning up to the fact that this idea is not original, but feeling that conservatives should be listed as well, I decided to make up a list of my own. In creating this list, I wrote down close to 60 names in less than 20 minutes. This goes again to show how uncreative Mr. D'Souza is. You can view this list via the favorite link section of the homepage for Indirect Democracy by clicking the link for Worst Conservatives. I was originally going to complete a list of 100 names, but I wanted your input. So, please write to me at david@indirectdemocracy.com to add additional names to this list of conservatives whose actions only harm the country by failing to see beyond ideology and partisanship to find ways to heal what ails our country, and not because we think they are in league with our enemies. Because his book and list lack spirit, originality, and could be created in his sleep, Dinesh D'Souza is the winner of this week's What a Weenie Award. Okay, that'll be it for this episode of Indirect Democracy. I'd like to thank you all for listening. I encourage you to go to the ARMS website. You can find the links for them through the MySpace page for Indirect Democracy. Just go down and you'll see them listed in recent music. You'll find the link for the ARM, or look on the Friends section of Indirect Democracy for the MySpace page, and you'll find the ARM there. I encourage you to go to their site, listen to more of their music, find ways to possibly purchase, if available, their music through their sites. But mostly, I do want to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find their music through their websites at www.megaphonemusic.net or through their MySpace page, which is myspace.com/megaphone. You can also purchase their album For Crying Out Loud through iTunes. Thank you once again for listening. Be sure to visit the homepage for Indirect Democracy. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and bye for now. Sinners.